It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the state's largest business group says it may sue the DNR over a new proposed rule on water pollution. We'll find out what's at stake. First, there's been a rise in low-paying service jobs in the United States over the last 50 years, and for the most part, those wages have been stagnant over that time period. One of the big economic schools of thought is that that's the market. Individual wages are determined by the value workers bring to a company. In other words, what you're paid is what you deserve according to market forces. Our next guest says, hang on. In a new book, he says wages are heavily influenced by worker bargaining power, and that since the 1980s, American employers and their political allies in both parties have effectively crushed worker power to the point now where many full-time workers aren't being paid a living wage. He says that's not just bad for the workers themselves. It's a factor in a number of major social problems, and it could tear the country apart. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Are you in one of these lower paid jobs without a lot of prospects for improvement? Did you or someone in your family move from a manufacturing job that isn't there anymore to a service sector job? Do you belong to a union? Do you see the balance of power changing over the last 50 years between employers and employees? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Michael Lind is a historian and columnist at Tablet Magazine. His latest book is called Hell to Pay, How the Suppression of Wages is Destroying America. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Let's start with this idea at the core of your argument that the many low-wage jobs in the U.S. aren't happening just because of market factors, but because of a decline in worker bargaining power. What do you see happening?
Well, the story told by the bipartisan establishment for the last 30 years has been that either because of technology or globalization, you need to improve your human capital to get higher wages. So jobs automatically reflect your skills in a global market or in a high-tech knowledge economy. And therefore, you need more education or more specific skills in order to get higher wages. I demonstrate in my book, Hell to Pay, that this is nonsense. Globalization and information technology have affected economies in Western Europe and in East Asia, like Japan and South Korea, and they have seen nothing like the extremes of inequality we see in the United States. So if globalization and technology and market forces were behind low wages and proliferating bad jobs in the U.S., you should see the same effect from the same causes everywhere in the world, and we don't. This is a very American problem.
So what are we doing in the United States that makes it a problem here?
Well, for one thing, deunionization, which has taken place to some degree in Western Europe, is much more extreme in the United States. In the private sector, the number of workers who belongs to a trade union has collapsed from about a third of the workforce in the 1950s to 6% and falling today. That is less than it was under Herbert Hoover before the New Deal. But even for workers who in professions that weren't part of trade unions traditionally, there are all kinds of devices that employers use to eliminate the power of workers to bid for higher wages. For example, there are contractual clauses that you have to sign a contract saying you're not going to compete with a competitor. There are illegal but widespread no poach agreements among firms in the same industry that promise each other, they collaborate secretly, saying they will not hire each other's employees. And that's another technique that reduces the ability of a worker to say, give me a raise or I'll go work for your competitor.
You don't see this as just being something that business leaders are doing. You point the blame also at leaders in both political parties for either changing the legal framework or not enforcing the laws we do have. What do you see happening in that? At least one thing you say some Democrats and Republicans agree on.
Well, the Democratic Party at this point pretends to be the friend of labor, and sometimes it is, but they haven't even been able to pass the PRO Act, you know, a very minor pro-labor measure, and it's way down their list of priorities, frankly, of most Democrats. Now, as I explain in my book, Hell to Pay, There are structural problems with the National Labor Relations Act that created the dominant modern form of organized labor in the United States. Under the NLRA, if you have a national company like Starbucks or Amazon, you can't unionize the whole company at once. Under this 1930s law, you have to organize each Starbucks coffee house or each Amazon warehouse. And that makes unionization much more difficult than it is in Western Europe and other parts of the world, where you have what is called sectoral bargaining. All of the employers in an industry bargain with all of the workers in that industry at the same time.
We're talking to Michael Lind about his new book. It's called Hell to Pay, How the Suppression of Wages is Destroying America. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a question for our guest, an experience in the workplace you'd like to share, policy changes you might like to see, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Michael, a lot of your book is about the consequences of what you're calling this long-term suppression of wages. One is we have people in a lot of sectors, retail, restaurants too, who work full-time and to make ends meet have to use some sort of public assistance. Effectively, you say taxpayers are subsidizing employers to pay low wages.
That's exactly right. We have what I call in my book, Hell to Pay, a low-wage, high-welfare system. I don't mean that our welfare state is generous. It's actually very miserly. What I mean is that we have millions of people, between a fifth and a quarter in the United States, who work full-time. They cannot support themselves, much less a child, without means-tested welfare programs like food stamps and housing vouchers and the earned income tax credit. Now, who benefits from this low-income, high-welfare system? It's two groups, employers of low-wage labor who know that the government will rescue their employees from poverty, even though they don't pay them enough to get out of poverty. And the other group is consumers, in some cases, of goods and services provided by these low-wage workers. So the problem is, this is a case of socializing the costs and privatizing the benefits. The benefits are privatized to low-wage employers who get higher profits by paying lower wages, and to some consumers. The rest of us, the taxpayers of the United States, are basically subsidizing these low-wage employers and low-wage goods and services consumers.
We talk on the show a lot about what falls in the category of deaths of despair, drug addiction, isolation, things like that. You see a direct line from the stagnant wages and these low-wage jobs and a lot of these wider social problems that might not immediately look connected. Connect the dots for us.
Well, we have a number of crises. One is the demographic crisis, which is families having fewer children than they tell pollsters they want to have. And when they're asked why, they say it's economic difficulties. We have a social crisis, and this is linked to the deaths of despair. Young Americans have fewer friends than any generation in American history, including the baby boomers. And part of this, I argue, is because particularly among working class young Americans, many of them have irregular schedules, sporadic work, gig jobs, things like that. It's hard to develop friends and relationships. And if you look at the professional class, which is doing quite well, they have a flourishing social life. You know, that you can, professionals can attend professional conventions. A lot of time they meet their mates, you know, through jobs that have steady payments. So whether we look at family formation or even things like friendship, which seems like it's completely cultural, I argue that there's an economic element there based on low wages and bad jobs and insecure schedules.
We're talking to Michael Lind. His new book is called Hell to Pay, How the Suppression of Wages is Destroying America. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you and your family? How has wage stagnation affected you? Do you have questions about the balance of power between employers and employees? Maybe policy solutions you would like to see us try? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Michael Lind. His new book is called Hell to Pay, How the Suppression of Wages is Destroying America. We'll go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. We've got Tom with us in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. I wonder if your guest could discuss the case of pay for caregivers, and in particular, child care. And I wonder how much of this is also, if another factor could be just how society values these workers.
Tom, thanks for the call. Michael, you talk some about child care policy in your book. What are your thoughts for Tom?
Well, that's right. Child care workers tend to be among the poorest paid workers in American society, which is really kind of shocking if you think about how important their job is. And if you look at nannies, for example, it's been calculated that the vast majority of the nannies in New York City are paid off the books. They are paid below the minimum wage. They don't have health benefits. Their employers are not providing Social Security. So it's particularly the unregulated side of childcare is a sweatshop industry, and it really needs to be regulated. When it comes to childcare policy, there's basically a difference among countries between those which want to give parents the funding to decide whether they want some of that funding to go to a family caregiver or a parent or institutional care. The business community in the United States favors institutional care only because it wants to maximize both parents being in the workforce for their own reasons, to have a larger workforce. So I think if you're pro-worker, but pro-family, you know, then you think that we should give child care subsidies to families, but the families should decide how they use them.
Thanks a lot for that call, Tom. Marcus joins us now in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. I was wondering your guest thoughts on kind of like the European model where they cap executive pay, where it can only be, I don't know if it's 50 times the lowest paid worker in any industry for the executives. Just so that way they keep some sort of parity. And my other thought is that if you don't have people that are earning a living wage and can actually go out and buy the products that we're producing in this country or that we're importing, how are the people at the top going to continue to receive money? Because they only purchase one garbage can a year or whatever other product. You know what I'm saying? They don't spend enough to actually keep the economy moving.
Marcus, thanks a lot for the call. Michael.
Yeah, two very good questions. I'm not familiar with any European countries that cap executive pay. There may be some that do it, but I'm not aware that that's a European union policy as a whole. If you have strong unions and bargaining power, then they're going to bid up the amount of profits that goes to the workers. And so you don't necessarily have to have a kind of rigid formal system like that. As far as your second question, the U.S. built its global economic primacy on a mass middle class where workers could afford to buy the goods and services they were providing. The danger is that we're splitting into two societies. And economists call this the dual economy model. You find this in many poor countries where you have an elite which buys luxury goods, often imports them from the global market. And then you have just a completely separate economy of shoddy second-class goods for working-class people. So, and the countries that have economies and social orders like that, like many in Latin America, not coincidentally don't have big flourishing home markets for their own producers, and they're not significant industrial countries.
Thanks a lot for that call, Marcus, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Michael Lind about his new book, Hell to Pay, How the Suppression of Wages is Destroying America. Let's go back to your calls now. Stan is with us in Green Bay. Hi, Stan.
Yeah, hi. I'm glad you said that the upper middle class in this country has actually gotten much larger and wealthier. I do agree that the working class on the flip side is struggling. But I'm just wondering, what is your cutoff for a living wage? What is your definition? Because where I live, there's a lot of manufacturing jobs and they're begging for people. And I can tell you what they're paying. But so I'm just curious what your cutoff is.
Well, in my book, I argue against a single definition in, for the entire United States. We're the third most populous nation in the world, second only to India and China. We have 330 million people and growing, and the standard of living between, you know, Arkansas and North Dakota and, say, big cities in the East Coast, the cost of living, there's enormous variation. So in Hell to Pay, I argue against like a single fixed minimum wage. I think the minimum wage should be raised, the federal minimum wage, and it should be indexed to inflation. But it would be better to have collective bargaining and also mechanisms like local wage boards, where the local cost of living can be reflected in particular industries, not for everybody, but in particular sectors like manufacturing.
Thanks for that call, Stan. And Stan, also, Michael, I think alluding to the idea that a lot of people are hiring now. We've seen over the last couple of years some bumps in the lower end of the pay scale, in part because of this weird situation we're in post worst of COVID. Does that give you signs of hope that lower wages will go up, or do you think this is a blip?
I think it's a blip. This is the third or fourth blip there's been since the 90s. The first one was associated with the tech bubble in 1999-2000, and then the tech bubble crashed. Then at the end of the Great Recession, after a decade, in 2018-19, wages began rising again, and that's just normal at the end of this quasi-depression like that. And finally, we had the reopening of the economy after the COVID lockdown was much more rapid than business anticipated. And so there was a brief period, which may now be ending, where workers had a lot of bargaining power. But having said that, from what I've seen, inflation has eroded most or all of the wage gains of workers at the bottom. So we need a system in which, even when the economy is running well, workers have bargaining power. You don't have to just wait for the occasional boom separated by long periods of stagnation.
Let's bring on another caller now. We've got Paul with us in Menominee. Paul, hi.
Hi. Could you comment on the huge amount of immigrants that are waiting to get in, are waiting to get in on the borders and the effect that's going to have on wages?
Paul, thanks for the call. Michael, you spend a lot of time on immigration in the book. My read, correct me if I'm wrong, is you don't see immigration as inherently good or inherently bad, but that companies have, in effect, weaponized immigration law to help prevent unionization and keep wages down. Do I have that about right?
Well, it depends on the kind of immigration, whether it's skilled or unskilled, family unification, and so on. There is no doubt, as I show in my book, Hell to Pay, that in specific sectors, the availability of large pools of low-wage immigrant labor, just as there would be if there were large pools of low-wage domestic labor, has allowed employers to destroy unions and lower wages. The Midwestern meatpacking industry was a well-paid, middle-class, highly unionized industry. The presence of, in this case, legal immigrants, for the most part, in the last generation, allowed the meat packers to wipe out the unions and to lower wages and benefits. And so when people tell you immigrants don't take jobs, immigrants don't take wages, it depends. It depends on the particular sector. And in these low wage sectors, where with minimal education requirements, the National Academies of Sciences, which is about the greatest authority you can have on the subject, in two studies in 1996 and 2016, said that low-wage immigration does indeed lower wages for low-wage workers in the U.S., including many former immigrants. They say, well, it also lowers prices, so some people are better off. But if we really believe that lowering wages to lower prices is a good thing, then we should get rid of the minimum wage altogether.
Thanks for that call, Paul. Michael, I want to spend a couple minutes on some of the solutions you offer. One is to give workers more power. It might not look like going back to, you know, the unionization we might think of from 30, 40 years ago, but some of those sector-based wage things. Could you talk a little bit about your solutions short of unions?
Certainly. In the worst paid businesses and industries, for like retail, construction, fast food, and a few others, I think we should concentrate those immediately, because that's where most of the really bad jobs with low wages are. And it's almost impossible to unionize workers, particularly at small fast food establishments and so on. You have to deal with the entire industry simultaneously. And we have a method which dates back 100 years in the United States, and some states have laws on their books about wage boards. Governor Andrew Cuomo raised wages for fast food workers in the state of New York by dusting off, you know, this old statute about wage boards that had not been used for half a century. Now, the way the wage board works, the governor or the mayor appoints a representative of all of the employers in an industry and all of the workers. And the workers don't have to be unionized under this system. And then they negotiate basic standards, wages, schedules, tailored to that particular occupation. So it doesn't apply to everybody in the city or the state. It's fast food workers or another occupation. And that's kind of the quickest, cleanest way, I think, that we can target the lowest paid workers in the United States and raise their wages. And fortunately, many of these service jobs can't be offshored to other countries and they can't be moved to other states. So it means that particular cities and particular states can use this wage board approach, as New York City and New York State has done. California is working on a wage commission proposal like this. And you can do it without fearing that you're going to lose business in those particular sectors in your own states.
Michael, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Michael Lind, author of the new book, Hell to Pay: How the Suppression of Wages is Destroying America. Coming up after the news, the state's largest business group has threatened to sue the DNR over a proposed new rule on water pollution. We'll take a look at that proposal, what it would do for lakes and streams around the state. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, you may think you bought a piece of technology, from a phone to major farm equipment, but in some ways you may be renting it. Find out how companies limit the ability to get their products repaired and sometimes charge subscription fees for you to continue using the stuff you bought. Now, the state's largest business association has threatened to sue the Department of Natural Resources over a proposed rule to tighten regulations on surface water pollution. Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce says the rule as is would exceed spending permitted under state law by more than $50 million. The DNR says the rule, which will be revised before the September deadline, will cost much less, just $2.5 million over 2 years. We're talking about potential changes to water pollution regulations in Wisconsin, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts on how Wisconsin laws work when it comes to water pollution? Do you want to see more regulation or less? Do you have concerns over how tighter regulations might affect your own business? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Dave Strifling is the director of the Marquette Law School's Water Law and Policy Initiative. Dave, welcome back to Central Time.
Rob, great to be with you. Thanks for having me again.
Can you walk us through what these new limits, these new regulations from the DNR would look like?
So there are a number of programs under the Clean Water Act that DNR has to follow. This is one specific category called the Anti-Degradation Program. And what the policy does is just what the name implies. It applies to the waters that are doing well, the waters that are in good condition, meeting water quality standards. And it tries to prevent them from degradation, to protect them from worsening water quality caused by new or increased discharges. So this is an existing program that DNR is just updating. It's not a new program. But there are some new requirements here, and that's what WMC is objecting to.
Yeah, could you talk a little bit about those new requirements?
Sure. So, you know, there is disagreement here, obviously, about exactly what is happening. But DNR, from its perspective, is just updating the anti-degradation program to reflect federal requirements that were enacted in 2015. It's defining what it means by high quality waters. It can do that on a water body based standard or on a parameter based standard. So it could say, for example, this is a high quality water for phosphorus. This is a high quality water for chloride, so on and so forth. It would also allow a cumulative impacts analysis that would consider multiple discharges to the same body of water. And it's also adding specifics about how DNR determines when a new discharge or an increased discharge would significantly lower water quality. There's a percentage basis of the water's assimilative capacity that's at issue here. It's going from a 33% reduction, tightening that up to a 10% reduction in water quality. So those are all areas of dispute between the two sides.
Yeah, and the DNR says, okay, we think it has this much economic impact. Wisconsin Manufacturing and Commerce comes up with a much higher number. What's going into those dueling readouts of the costs of this?
Yeah, so I'm not an economist, but here's how I read it. DNR's estimate says that this is going to have an impact of about $2 million over 2 years. So from DNR's perspective, that's not altogether significant. WMC's estimate is over $50 million. So WMC is estimating that DNR has vastly underestimated the cost of this revision to the anti-degradation program. And it comes down to WMC's claim that DNR has both underestimated the number of permittees and underestimated the cost per permittee that this program will affect. And there's a lot of specifics in WMC's comments that we probably don't have time to get into the weeds on, but you could look at things like the treatment that's required, the delay in projects, the impact of a second discharge, a new discharge by the same permittee. All of those are feeding into that $50+ million estimate. And it's really significant because if the cost of the regulation is over $10 million over a two-year period, the agency needs legislative authorization, in effect, a law passed by the legislature that would authorize it to issue the rule, and that has not happened. So if a court were to determine that the cost of this is over $10 million, the rule could not go into effect under current Wisconsin law.
Talking to Dave Strifling with Marquette Law School's Water Law and Policy Initiative, looking at DNR changes to pollution regulations for bodies of water in the state, possible legal lawsuit or legislative action on it. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Dave, this would apply to a variety of industries and economic groups. Some of the groups raising concerns are in agriculture, some of the larger scale dairy operations. What could this mean for them?
Well, there's some dispute about whether CAFOs, concentrated animal feeding operations, are covered under the rule. So if those are swept in, that would obviously have significant implications for them. There's also stormwater discharges that are covered under the rule, if not covered under a general permit that WDNR has issued. So that would have significant implications for the agricultural industry as well. One thing to realize here, though, is this is just a proposed rule. This is not a final rule yet. WDNR still has to go back and consider all the comments it has received before it even issues a final rule to the Natural Resources Board for approval. It says it's thinking about doing that in September. So we've still got some time to see how all this is going to play out.
There's a lot of legal nuance here, obviously, Dave. What ultimately is at stake? How big a difference are these distinctions among parties here going to make when it comes to the actual quality of these lakes and streams we're talking about?
Well, I think it could be significant, especially when we're talking about those higher quality waters, outstanding resource waters, exceptional resource waters, and really any waterway that's meeting water quality standards, that's meeting the designated uses that the state has laid out, whether that be fishable, swimmable, drinkable, you name it, all of those could come under fire here if this rule does not go into effect. And, you know, WMC's threat of litigation is one thing, but what also will come into play here is what Republican legislators think about the rule. And that's important because under some recent changes to Wisconsin law, there's a legislative committee called the Joint Committee on the Review of Administrative Rules that can essentially put the rule on indefinite hold. And so it's not just WMC that we have to be thinking about here. It's also the Wisconsin legislature that could impact the progress of this rule.
We're talking to Dave Strifling, director of Marquette Law School's Water Law and Policy Initiative, looking at new water pollution regulations proposed by the DNR that have been criticized by some in the business community. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think new water regulations should apply to the CAFOs, these larger livestock operations? Are you concerned about these proposed DNR rules? Have you been following this? Is this an important issue in your community, in your local lake or river? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Dave Strifling, director of Marquette Law School's Water Law and Policy Initiative, looking at water pollution in Wisconsin, some new rules proposed by the DNR that have been challenged by business groups. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your biggest concerns when it comes to clean water and water regulations here in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller. Brian is with us in Rice Lake. Brian, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up?
What are departees? And what is the Verdilla something that they
the
using?
Degradation, I think you're looking for, Brian. Can you talk, Dave, about what we mean degradation that's at the center of this DNR proposed policy?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're looking at those high quality waters that meet water quality standards. There are separate programs under the Clean Water Act to address the waters that aren't doing so well. This one has to do with trying to protect the waters that are meeting water quality standards. And so one of the big issues here is, yeah, what does it mean to have a significant lowering of water quality in those high quality waters? Should it be 10%? Should it be 33%? Courts have come down at a number of different places, and the EPA does not specify exactly where that bar should fall in terms of exactly what it means to be significant. So that's part of the issue here that DNR is trying to address in the rule.
Thanks for the call, Brian. Now, talking about courts and the Clean Water Act, well, the U.S. Supreme Court issued an important ruling that, in effect, rolls back some of the Clean Water Act, at least on certain kinds of water. Dave, what happened there?
Yeah, so this is an area concerning wetlands and the federal government's jurisdiction over wetlands. In other words, when do you need a federal permit to fill a wetland on your property for development because you want to build a home or build a shopping mall or whatever the case may be? And the court sharply limited federal jurisdiction over wetlands as compared to a pretty longstanding interpretation of its precedent. And so what that does is throw the onus onto states to try to protect wetlands within their boundaries. And states are all across the board on what they've done on that score. And so ultimately what I think the immediate position is that many less wetlands are protected under federal law. And we know now that wetlands aren't just swamps. They're not wastelands to be filled. They're actually really important ecologically for a number of reasons, from storm surge buffers to pollutant filtration to habitat for wildlife to interchange between groundwater and surface water. Lots of important ecosystem services that they fulfill. So this is an important decision.
The argument, I think, was that, okay, if you have smaller wetlands, maybe ephemeral is the word sometimes used, they come and go over time, they're not directly connected to streams and rivers and things like that, then the Clean Water Act just didn't apply to them. It shouldn't, the argument was, I think, have applied to them in the first place. How big a part of the story is that?
Yeah, that's a big part of the story. And I think what we've got happening here is a little bit of a disconnect between the law and the science. The scientists would say, and I think, again, I'm not a scientist, but my understanding is that almost all water is connected. Whether it's groundwater or surface water, it's all part of the same water cycle, especially if it's nearby. What the Supreme Court said in the decision is, to be jurisdictional under federal law, we need a surface connection, not just a groundwater connection between a wetland and a traditional water of the United States, like a river or a stream or a lake. If we don't have that, if you can't go out into your backyard and see a continuous surface connection between the wetland and the traditional water, we're going to say there's no federal jurisdiction, because we just think that your average person doesn't have the ability or maybe the financial means to test whether there's a groundwater connection, which had been part of the previous test.
Oh, briefly, what does this mean for Wisconsin? What is our level of wetland protection compared to what just changed under federal law?
Wisconsin has done more than most states. You do need a permit generally for discharge into wetlands in Wisconsin. However, in 2017, the legislature acted to exempt some wetlands from that rule, and they're the smaller ones. 3 acres or less in size in rural areas, 1 acre or less in size in urban areas. That category of wetlands now is more likely to be completely unregulated under the Clean Water Act.
Let's bring on another caller now. Todd is with us in De Pere. Todd, hi.
Hi. Just a comment on CAFOs and residential non-point pollution. I fish Lake Winnebago, and every year in the summer, I can see that lake. It's terrible. It's disgusting. The algae blooms, and it's not just the CAFOs. I'm sure it's lawn fertilizers, non-point pollution, but the CAFOs. I live in a rural area. I see them dumping semi loads after semi loads of raw sewage next to runoff creeks and areas. It's just getting to Lake Winnebago. They have to be held accountable.
Todd, thanks for the call. Dave, what is the state of the art of regulating that kind of manure disposal and non-point pollution that finds its way into, say, Lake Winnebago?
Yeah, non-point source pollution is really tough. Not regulated under the Clean Water Act. Wisconsin has done something to regulate it via its stormwater regulations. But I think what the caller is really talking about is an enforcement question. You know, if it's being done in violation of a permit that a CAFO has, that's not a really a legal question. That's an enforcement question for DNR.
Thanks for the call, Todd. And Dave, yeah, as I understand it, if I open a CAFO and get a permit for it, I have to have some kind of manure management plan, right?
Correct. That is correct.
Again, Todd, thanks for the call. Dave, as you mentioned, the DNR rule we started off talking about here, it is a proposal. It's got a while to go. What kind of things are you watching for that could potentially change over the next couple few months?
Well, the big thing is going to be what DNR does with that cost estimate, because it already received some of WMC's comments on its preliminary fiscal estimate, and it bumped the cost up a little bit, less than $1 million, though. So it's still well beneath that $10 million threshold. And that's going to be, I think, the key point of dispute between the parties, because WMC is obviously reading the rule to include many more requirements than perhaps WDNR is, and is estimating the cost differently as a result. So, you know, it's going to be a question of where that final cost ends up, and then, of course, what the Wisconsin legislature does, if it allows this rule to proceed or if it hangs it up in the Joint Committee on the Review of Administrative Rules. Both of those are items to watch, I think.
Dave, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks. My pleasure.
That's Dave Strifling, director of Marquette Law School's Water, Law, and Policy Initiative. He talked to us about proposed pollution regulations here in the state and a potential legal challenge down the road. Plus, we took a quick look at that U.S. Supreme Court ruling putting some limits on the Clean Water Act when it comes to wetlands around the country. Now, childcare in Wisconsin is expensive and it's hard to find. At the same time, childcare providers are one of the lowest paid kinds of workers in the state. Now, temporary federal pandemic aid for child care providers is ending. Corrine Hess reports that workers and families could face some difficult choices.
When Diana Wells found out she was pregnant in 2018, she started searching for reliable child care. And then she heard horror stories about potential providers in the Madison area being understaffed and unexpectedly shutting down.
And the cost was incredible.
Wells told her story at an event in New Glarus. While pregnant, she joined a year-long waiting list to get into Corrine's Little Explorers, which is owned by her sister-in-law, Corrine Hendrickson. But it's an hour drive from Wells' home in Verona. Now, her 4-year-old son and 3-year-old daughter are at Corrine's Little Explorers. She says her children are thriving, but to make it work, Wells had to cut back her hours as a teacher in the Verona area school district.
2 hours of my day is spent in the car when I can't be prepping for my lessons, I can't be grading.
Her story is not unusual. Child care in Wisconsin is expensive and hard to find. A report from the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association found over half of the state is in a child care desert. A separate report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum found the average two-income household in Wisconsin spends 17% of their income on care for one child. For the last 3 years, Wisconsin child care providers have been buoyed by a federal pandemic relief program that helped them improve pay for their employees while keeping tuition costs for families down. In June, funding for that program, called Child Care Counts, will be cut in half. Democratic Governor Tony Evers included $340 million in his state budget proposal to stabilize the program. So far, that funding remains intact, but it's seen as at risk as Republicans rewrite the budget. And preserving that funding is the subject of a statewide campaign among child care professionals and advocates. Sean Fedaplace is with Main Street Alliance, a liberal trade group for small businesses. He says the future of child care counts affects everyone.
If we don't get at least a good amount of funding to that program, I think you're going to see mass exodus of staff. And you're also going to see huge rate increases for parents, too. And I don't think that gets fully appreciated yet, just like how devastating this would be.
Even as the cost of childcare has risen, childcare providers themselves often struggle to earn a living wage. The average pay for the profession is between $7 and $12 an hour, making it one of the lowest paid occupations in the state, according to the Wisconsin Policy Forum. But there's also a limit to how much providers can charge parents. Some families already decide to have a parent leave the workforce rather than pay the high cost of daily care. State data shows about 4,900 child care providers across the state received an average of $116,000 each through the Child Care Counts program. An October survey of Wisconsin providers found 60% will have to increase tuition when the program expires. Back at the New Glarus event, Wanda Legler says she spent her career in the child care industry because it suits her. But at age 70, Legler says she's fed up that the government hasn't done more to improve wages. She thinks it's because some legislators don't support careers for women.
A lot of these people making the decisions, they honestly feel that we should just be home, taking care of our kids. And I've seen it and I've bumped into it over and over and over again.
After several hours, the event wraps up with parents feeling grateful and providers hopeful. And right now, Diana Wells has figured out what works best for her family. But she's already starting to worry about next year, when her son starts kindergarten in Verona and her daughter is an hour away at a New Glarus daycare. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, we were just talking about a big water quality issue here in Wisconsin. On a related note, another big issue here in the state, algae blooms. What causes them and the impact they can have on our lakes and streams and the ecosystems that surround them and our use of them, plus a look at invasive species in Wisconsin waterways. Then find out why Finland is the happiest country on the planet, at least according to one measure of happiness, and what we might learn from that country. You can join in both of those conversations, and you can join in right now. Email ideas@wpr.org. Give us a report on your local waterway, your lake or stream. Are you seeing these algae blooms more and more over the years? Are you seeing them already just after we kicked off a June in your local lake? What do you think is the cause? What questions do you have about causes and possible solutions? Email ideas@wpr.org, then join the conversation tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Yesterday on the show, we talked about great places to go for a hike here in Wisconsin. You shared some of your favorites, and we heard from some more of you online. Rose on the Ideas Network Facebook page writes, "Just listening to Central Time talking about hikes in Wisconsin, enjoying the conversation. We're segment hiking the Ice Age Trail and really like the short Tish Mills segment. It has a water crossing at a creek. It was oh so refreshing after hiking 8 miles that day." David emails, "My favorite hike is Tower Hill State Park in Spring Green, because when you get to the top at the tower, it has a little museum about the history of mining in the area and the former town of Helena, Wisconsin." And on Facebook, Mark sums up the consensus: Wisconsin has some of the best hiking trails in the Midwest. Keep sharing your favorite hikes on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Stay hydrated if you're hiking this weekend. It's going to be pretty warm in most of the state. This is Central Time.